Back together again, you and I wrapping up a busy week, Friday, October 20th, 2023 on Connecticut Today. More allegations, yeah, we talked about them, connected to absentee ballot use in Bridgeport. We chatted about that report and more with former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso during his weekly report. We also welcomed Roy Idelson, author of Doing Harm, How the World's Largest Psychological Association Lost Its Way in the War on Terror. All right, Friday, we've made it. Now, I want to start off the show with this. And, you know, every Thursday in the 5 o'clock hour, we kick off our merry little program here, our little get-together with our buddy, our pal, Lenny Grimaldi, onlyinbridgeport.com. You hear Lenny on the air with me every Thursday. You know his history in the city. He knows, politically at least, where all the bodies are buried. Some people like him, some people don't, but he's a good reporter. And this is interesting, and if I can read this on the air, which I will right now, at least the allegations being made here, if I can read it, if you can read it, if I can understand it, if you can understand it, then it seems to me, boys and girls, that people watching the Bridgeport ballot situation, where, as you heard in the top of the hour news there from Chris, should be settled sometime in the next week or so. We don't know. But again, this all plays into my thought here that there's we're not lacking information here. Okay, we're not lacking evidence, verified evidence. We're not lacking supposed evidence. There's stuff there, and you wonder again, and I hesitate to say that I'm repeating myself, but I am, because I just get, my fear is that nothing is going to change. Lenny posted this yesterday. John Gomes supporter Pereira banned from public housing properties. Multiple complaints filed with police for harassing seniors re-absentee ballots. This is not me saying this. I'm just reading this to you. This is a report from onlyinbridgeport.com. I will read the headline again. I'm just telling you what's out there, so don't shoot the messenger here. You should go read this, because if this is true, this is serious stuff here. And the question begs over and over and over, what is anybody going to do about it? Gomes supporter Pereira banned from public housing properties. Multiple complaints filed with police for harassing seniors, re-absentee ballots. That's a pretty stiff charge here. So the story reads thusly, if you don't have online access or you haven't gotten around to reading this story that was posted yesterday. And again, I'm not vouching for the veracity of what people have said about her or the charges, but you should know this is out there. Following complaints filed with police from senior citizens who assert they've been intimidated and harassed, leadership at Park City Communities, that manages multiple housing properties in the city, has banned, says here, City Councilwoman Maria Pereira from entering any of its properties. That's according to multiple sources and only in Bridgeport.com. Pereira is mayoral candidate John Gomes' preeminent excavator of absentee ballots, working her heavy senior citizen constituency in the Upper East Side. She lost her council seat with the walk-in vote, but survived via a heavy barrage of absentee ballots. Multiple seniors who feared retribution for publishing names have also told Only in Bridgeport about Pereira's intimidation tactics. Again, folks, this is not me saying this. I'm simply reading a report. You can decide how you wish. A surveillance camera last month captured Pereira entering the vacant Fireside apartment home of a senior in search of her absentee ballot. Pereira claimed she had permission. She's also on video placing absentee ballots into one of the four city drop boxes that have become the central evidence of Gomes' challenge of Mayor Joe Ganim's 251 primary vote win before the state court. All right, the piece is longer, and you can read it. Check it out. I'll put it on our station Facebook page at WICC, facebook.com/WICC600. So you've got Lenny here, our buddy, our pal Lenny Grimaldi, saying he has seniors telling him, or sources telling him, that seniors are being intimidated. These are the reports here. These are serious allegations. Once again, I don't reside in the city of Bridgeport. I watch it from afar. I get my two hot dogs and my beer, buy an $8 ticket on StubHub, and go sit in the upper deck and watch what's going on. So, is there any, assuming that there is a grain of truth here, let's assume one or two grains of truth. So what do we do about it? And I know people are going to say, well, this is already illegal. And maybe, I don't know what the laws are. Well, we know what the laws are. That in essence, you're not allowed to ballot harvest. You're not. Absentee ballots are only to be handled by the voter, him or herself, a relative, a police officer, an officially designated caregiver, or an election official, not a campaign official. So again, with who knows what this judge is going to say, is anybody paying attention here? Because again and again, I read this stuff, and it seems like, and you're at least getting some rhetoric out of the General Assembly and out of people like Common Cause and Sherry Quickmire, who was quoted the other day as saying, well, you know, and again, I'm paraphrasing, this is not exactly what she said, but said, well, there's kind of this pall over Bridgeport. Is this what's expected? Because we have this mess, whomever's going to be found at fault. We had the mess in 2019, and there's a connection, allegedly, one person involved in both. Don't believe me. Read the media accounts. I'm just the messenger here. And there's been allegations of this for years. So you tell me what's going to happen here. Is anything going to happen? Or are you like me? Has the great God cynicism on a Friday here, the 20th of October, 2023, are you starting to become a little cynical like me? And are you starting to say, nah, it'll all blow over and nothing will change? Now, let me ask you something. Why should anybody who is not, and I had a couple of guests on this on the show back in 2019, and I know there is a procedure to get absentee ballots filled out in some of these senior housing complexes, and we read a couple of weeks ago that the secure absentee ballot thing is only for nursing homes of 20 or more. Basically, the state mandate would only kick in with two properties in Bridgeport. The rest of the properties would have to request some sort of added security or whatever. I forget how it was actually worded in the story. But is anybody going to do anything about this? I mean, for example, what is this company here again? No. Park City Communities. Now, is it not incumbent upon them? And I have no idea who works for that company. I have no idea, you know, whatever. So is it now perhaps incumbent upon them, coming from dummy me who knows nothing about this? But at least I think I have the common sense where I can sit back and say, hey, no more of people coming in here with these absentee ballot runs unless there is a police officer present, unless there is somebody from the registrar's office present, Democrat and or Republican. See, here's my question. Are some of the people complicit in this? Allegedly, if something happened here, we have to be right here. Do the people at some of these nursing homes, some of these senior facilities, do they care enough? I mean, if you go by this, and this is a published report, I'm not the only one seeing this, it's on a very widely read website here. Following complaints filed with police from seniors who assert they've been intimidated and harassed, the city has banned City Councilwoman Maria Pereira from entering any of its properties, on and on and on, yada, yada, yada. Why? And again, these are allegations, but it's embarrassing, is it not? Does anybody care about this? Or is this to the point, it's Bridgeport, how things work? Says right here, apparently seniors complain to police. Huh? This is the kind of stuff that goes on in, like, banana republics? So you have people going into, allegedly, and this is not the first I've heard of this. Other people have told me this on and off the record here. Does this bother anybody? Hello? Anybody watching? Does this bother anybody that you apparently have a practice, legal or otherwise, where I guess in the past, and allegations made here, you know, campaign people and candidates have gone in and whatever, say, hey, let's all fill out absentee ballots. Is anybody awake here? Or maybe not enough people care. Maybe, you know what? Hey. The streets get plowed. The police come when they're called. The cops come when they're called. Everybody has their jobs. So does no one care? See, to me, this is not about candidate A, B, C, or D. That's not what the point is. The point is, at least according to this report, it alleges that complaints have been filed with police from seniors who say they've been intimidated and harassed. Really? Really? Now, you may say, well, why, you know, that could be garbage. So they're risking filing a false criminal report, which is in and of itself a low-level crime. But I guess, you know, some things get so ingrained, I guess. Maybe people don't care. Do you? All right, fourth and final hour. We'll get back to open phones in just a bit. When we do that, to wrap it up, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. By the way, there's already a projection out on what might happen with the 5th District congressional race that's coming up next November. Again, looks to be a redux between the incumbent Johanna Hayes and George Logan, unless George Logan is primaried in that race by Sage Steele, recently of ESPN, but we have a year to worry about that. Right now, though, former Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso joins us with his Friday report on what has been in his mind the past several days. Mr. Caruso, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hello, Paul. How are you doing today?
Chris, I'm living the dream. And again, as I tell people when they ask me that, it's too late for law school, so I might as well keep doing this. So that's where I am, Chris. Chris, there's never a shortage of things, my friend. What's on your mind? Let's start off there.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I want to state that this year was a banner year for the 115th Greater Bridgeport Columbus Day Parade and the Marine Band Concerts. We had great attendance at all of the events. The parade in particular was a beautiful sunny day. Great crowd came out to watch the parade. Our inaugural feast of St. Francis went off very well, and our Crown Cafe, our pre-parade central, also did well this year, and we're very happy that everyone came out to enjoy the parade and a little bit of Italian this year. Even if you're not Italian, they came out and they celebrated the Italian heritage and tradition. So it was a great year, and I want to thank all the volunteers, the Grand Marshal, Nancy DiNardo, all the veteran groups who help with the Marines and WICC, and you, Paul, because I know you've interviewed the band in the past and this year again, and it was just, I think, one of our best and biggest years that we've had. So it was just a great time to be Italian and to celebrate our heritage.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. And the second thing I want to mention is last night there was a Zoning Board of Appeals session in Bridgeport City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, on the Westfield Avenue and Madison Avenue property, the old Testo site, the city had revoked the permit from the property owner. And so he appealed that decision of the zoning official to the Zoning Board of Appeals. And last night, the Zoning Board of Appeals failed to sustain the appeal. So the appeal was denied last night. And so at this point, the owner can't develop that property as he had planned to. He has two choices. He can come in with a new application for that property or go into court and ask a judge to rule in his favor so that he can go ahead and build what he had proposed to do. So last night was a victory for the neighbors. You know, when you look at that, Paul, it was a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
The neighbors had no input into it. And now what it's done is it's actually positioned it where the neighbors will have a say. I think the owner's interested in talking to the neighbors, which I think is always good, and hopefully a resolution can come out of it. But from where we were to where we are now as a neighborhood, they've come a long way, and that's due to the credit of all the neighbors and the people that fought to bring it to where it is today.
Chris, and I know you and I have talked about this on the Testo's property before. Do you get a sense, and I'm just asking your opinion, I know this isn't, this isn't right. Do you get a sense that maybe the neighborhood is saying, okay, maybe something smaller? Because I know one of the things that you talked about and some of the stuff I'm reading in the Post is that the just number one, they think the size is too big for that area. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you bring up a good point, Paul. 177 apartments with underground parking garages is just too much for that neighborhood. So I think, you know, a less densely populated development would probably work. I think the whole rub to this thing with the neighbors is they never had a say. And keep in mind, this is a working class neighborhood, mm-hmm. all good, decent people paying their taxes, their mortgages, raising kids, going to work every day, and they had absolutely no say in what was going to be developed there. And it was pretty much take it or leave it. And, you know, if you have an opinion, too bad, because it's already been approved and it's a done deal. And I think if the neighbors get a chance to speak with the owner and try to work through it, I think something can come out of it that would work hopefully for the owner and the neighborhood. But I think a less densely populated development there would work. Maybe some form of elderly housing,
mm-hmm.
where it's not as densely populated, not a high rise, but could accommodate elderly people. I think that may work. There's just a lot of thoughts out there of what could be done. But, you know, keep in mind this 177 development would only have 155 parking spaces. So could you imagine that? And on that neighborhood, the side streets would be full of vehicles.
Yeah, what do you do if you have – never mind if you live there, Chris. What if you have folks visiting at the holidays? I mean,
And that's part of the problem. You know, that whole neighborhood, Paul, is a residential single-family development housing. And here this building is being proposed and, again, no input. But I always believe with conversation comes compromise and discussion, and I think that's what has to happen here. Hopefully the owner takes that route and tries to come to a resolution. But do I feel the neighbors are interested in talking? Yes, I think they are. I think from the very beginning, but they've been shut out of the process up to this point. And interestingly, at the hearing, the owner did say to people that he didn't realize the neighborhood was shut out. So when he bought the property, he was assured that everything was approved by zoning. It was a green light, and he would just go ahead and build. And so it seems like he was misled in the process as well, and that came out at the hearing that evening. So it's a victory for this battle with the neighborhood. There's still more to go, but, you know, congratulations to all the neighbor and the work they did to bring it to this point. And that shows the power of people. You know, they were dealing against powerful, influential political operatives in the city. And here, neighborhood, decent, good people that fought, and they won to this point. So good for them, and good for the power of people, the actual people who live in that neighborhood.
Chris, let me ask you, in the minutes we have left here, of course, the testimony is all done in the absentee ballot case. I mean, you know, both attorneys, Mr. Bloss and the other attorney, you know, they tried their best. Who knows what the judge is going to do? But, Chris, I floated something, and now we have this latest report in Only in Bridgeport, Lenny Grimaldi's blog about, you know, Maria Pereira and people saying, hey, you know, and she shouldn't be allowed in the building, whatever. Those are allegations. Chris, you know this stuff far, far better than I would. You know, we have cities like Bridgeport at one time and currently West Haven where if your finances are just being disregarded, the city can come, the state can come in and say, hey, okay, we're going to be the hall monitor here for a few years and straighten you out. I just kind of toss this up in the air, Chris, depending upon what happens here. This is at least two cycles that we know of. There's been the, as you say, the inference over the years. Does the state of Connecticut have any power, Chris, to say, okay, you can still run the ballot machines. We get it. You can run that. But we are going to, from point A to B, we are going to run the absentee ballot process. We're going to set up an office in City Hall or Town Hall. We're going to have state inspectors there. You people don't touch the absentees. Is that possible or not?
I think so, Paul. I don't recall when I served as the chair of the Government Administration Elections Committee, any state statute that would prohibit that from happening. It would have to be created by the legislature, as the financial oversight panels were as well.
Yeah.
And I think it could be. And I, you know, Paul, I never thought of that idea. I wish I knew you back then, because that would have been a great idea to propose. I think it makes a lot of sense. The only thing I would suggest is you can't just put the absentee ballots under review. I think you'd have to put the whole election.
Okay.
So you allow the municipality to run the election, but the state review board would have oversight over the election. And then, you know, once you've had a couple of cycles of elections and they're run fairly and objectively, then the review board, similar to the financial review boards, can back off at that point and let the city run it without any oversight. Keep in mind, the legislature has already appointed on several occasions election monitors for Bridgeport. So you could extend the power of that election monitor and put an advisory board with the monitor. So it is doable. The problem with our statutes currently is the Secretary of State is considered the chief election officer of the state, but very, very limited powers, because the powers exist through the Registrar of Voters Office, the town clerk's office. And every time, even when I was in the legislature, we tried to bring more power to the Secretary of State. There was this hue and cry from the locals that, oh, my God, you know, home rule, and we want to do this, we want to do that. It was like we, you know, just took away their last slice of pumpkin pie, you know. And that was always the issue. So, but if there's the will of the legislature and the public and those advocacy groups for good government that fight, yeah, it's definitely doable, Paul, and it makes perfect sense. But in addition, as a caveat to that, this panel should also be allowed to recommend solutions to the legislature.
Sure.
For example, mandatory jail time for people who violate election law, especially absentee ballot fraud. That's critically important. And I think the legislature is pulling away from that because, again, incumbencies have depended on the absentee ballot process. Now, it's interesting, Paul. The Elections Enforcement Commission has targeted five elderly housing complexes in Bridgeport that they're part of their investigation. It was in the paper the other day.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be investigating those five housing complexes where there's been complaints that have taken place. So that's already going to happen. Enfield, Connecticut, if you read in the paper, is having an election issue too. And there's been other cities as well. So, again, I just want to emphasize to your listeners, this is not just a Bridgeport problem. It is happening all over the state. Now, to different degrees and magnitudes, but it's still happening all over the state. But I think your idea of this levels of comparable to a financial review makes sense when it comes to election oversight. And the legislature, which has the power under the Constitution to regulate elections, this could be something that would really make a lot of sense. And it comes in when there's a series of violation of election law. And then at that point, once the problems have been resolved, the elections are done fairly and objectively, that board can step back again. But no, I think in any democracy, if there's anything impeding a fair and objective election, the state has an obligation, if you will, to step in and to right the wrong, to make it work for all the citizens of that community. So hats off to you, Paul. I thought it was a great idea.
Thank you.
I heard it earlier today, and I said, you know, sometimes the simplest solutions make the most sense. And you already have in place this financial review board. You already have a model. So it's something already in statute that you could replicate when it comes to elections and how elections are run. The only thing, as I mentioned, you don't want to just single out absentee ballots.
Sure.
You'd have to put the whole election under the process of this board of review, and the absentees would be part of it. And simple enough, just an extension of the election monitor's authority and responsibilities. So it makes perfect sense, Paul.
All right, Chris, thank you. Chris, have a wonderful weekend. We'll check in with you next week.
All right, take care, Paul.
Thank you, Chris Caruso there. See, I had a decent idea. See, every so often when I flap my gums, something with some level of sense comes out. Not too often, but enough. All right, let's take a little time out. We'll get back to the open phones next half hour when we do that. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Fascinating book here. Our next guest has been a practicing clinical research and political psychologist for over 30 years. His work focusing on applying psychological knowledge and principles to issues of social justice and political change. Name of the book is Doing Harm, How the World's Largest Psychological Association Lost Its Way in the War on Terror. It came out last month. Get it anywhere you get your books, local bookstores. Yeah, they're still around. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all that, of course, online. Dr. Roy Idelson is the guest. Dr. Idelson, hi, it's Paul here, WICC. Good afternoon.
Hi, Paul. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it. Kind of a rather pointed title there, How the World's Largest Psychological Association, A, Lost Its Mind, B, During the War on Terror. So what do we mean, Dr. Idelson, by the biggest psychological association? What did they do, when, and what in your mind was wrong about it?
Sure. So the world's largest psychological association is the American Psychological Association, also known as the APA. Mm-hmm. It has over 100,000 members, headquartered in Washington, D.C., and it is basically the voice of professional psychology in the United States. After the terrorist attacks of September 11th, the APA went in two directions. One, which was a good thing, is they organized psychologists to provide pro bono services in New York City, in Washington, and elsewhere to help those who were struggling with the trauma of the horrific attacks. But the problem is, at the same time, the APA decided that it wanted to get involved in counterterrorism activities. And as a result, despite the fact that my profession has a fundamental commitment to do no harm, psychologists ended up on the front lines in regard to brutal interrogations of hundreds of Muslim men and boys at CIA black sites, at Guantanamo Bay, and so on. So the APA really, in my view, went off the rails in terms of what our profession should be committed to.
The APA members, Dr. Idelson, that you say did this, was this of their own volition? Were they acting emotionally out of a series of patriotism or a sense of patriotism, or were they pressured to do this? Why did they, in your mind, take the wrong avenue here?
Well, it was a combination, Paul, of just the points you made. Undoubtedly, some of it was driven by a sense of patriotism. Some of it was pressure from the Department of Defense and the CIA. But part of it, a significant part, was, in my view, opportunism. This was a chance to expand the roles that psychologists would have in the United States. And some of the specific psychologists involved in torture were paid enormous sums of money. There were two CIA contract psychologists who created a small firm, and the government paid them $81 million.
Wow.
For work.
That's a little higher than the going hourly rate, Dr. Idelson, I would think.
Indeed it is.
Yeah. Does the prior to this CIA, DIA, DOD, Pentagon, they have staff, psychiatric and psychological professionals on staff, do they not? Just working in general?
Yes, they have psychologists, clinical psychologists, for example, the Department of Defense, the Department of Veterans Affairs. They have clinical psychologists whose work is to help soldiers and veterans deal with the psychological struggles either during their time at war or afterwards. That's important work. Psychologists have special training, and they can really make a difference in terms of that. What fewer psychologists are involved in is the detention and interrogation work that was exceedingly abusive during the war on terror. And along with other, what we were called dissident psychologists, we wanted the APA to take a stand against those activities, and they essentially did the opposite, saying that it was important to have psychologists involved in that kind of work because psychologists would keep those interrogations safe, legal, ethical, and effective, and none of that was true.
The name of the book, Doing Harm, How the World's Largest Psychological Association Lost Its Way in the War on Terror. Dr. Roy Idelson is the guest. So, Dr. Idelson, walk me and my listeners through, you know, without getting overly graphic, what would the role be of a psychologist here who decided to work for the Pentagon, work for the CIA? Do they come up with lines of training? Do they do the interrogation themselves? Do they teach people how to interrogate? Do they come up with cues? Walk us through what one of the roles may be that you found distasteful.
Okay, sure. Psychologists were involved at multiple levels. Some psychologists were involved in designing the interrogation techniques. They were called enhanced interrogation techniques, but that's a euphemism basically for torture. So they designed techniques such as waterboarding, which is basically when you drown someone or threaten them with the experience of drowning. They humiliated detainees. There's a case where a detainee was forced to perform dog tricks and had a leash around his neck. There were techniques where detainees were put into small coffin-sized boxes in total darkness for hours at a time. They were isolated for weeks at a time where they had no meaningful contact with any other human being. Psychologists designed those techniques. At the CIA, psychologists actually performed some of these abusive tactics. For the Department of Defense, they didn't perform them, but they observed and provided guidance on essentially how to break down these individuals. The idea being if they're broken down, they're more likely to provide useful information. We got no useful information from torture because torture, in addition to being abominable, doesn't work.
Would there have been, Dr. Idelson, a different way? Could you have seen yourself, for example, or some of the dissident members, as you say, of the APA, doing this but saying, hey, let's try something different here. I think we can get some info. We can find out how these people tick, but there's another way to do this. Would that have been possible, you think, or not?
There are definitely interrogation techniques that are not coercive in the way that the abusive techniques are. So they are based on building rapport with the individual. And, you know, they don't involve harming him psychologically, physically, and so on. So those are more effective. You can get useful information from those techniques. Whether psychologists, given our commitment to do no harm, should be the ones doing that is a complex ethical question, because those interrogation techniques, the rapport building ones, may be appropriate, but that doesn't mean that we need psychologists as professionals to be involved in that.
Name of the book is Doing Harm, How the World's Largest Psychological Association Lost Its Way in the War on Terror. Dr. Idelson, we touched on this earlier, but do you think the people in your profession that participated in this without being coerced, were they angry? Were the psychologists themselves showing the human side that they may have been dealing with too, of the anger of what happened on 9/11, and maybe, you know, in your mind, compromised what they could or should have done had they waited a bit or had the attack not been as cataclysmic as it was?
I think that's absolutely right. There was the whole war on terror in various ways was driven by vengeance and seeking revenge. And those psychologists who were at the front line were immersed in those feelings and that mentality. And I think they may have adopted it. The problem, and it's bad, what's even more regrettable is that an organization like the APA didn't stand up as it could have and say, this is not okay for psychologists. If the APA had taken a strong stand, like other human rights organizations did, things may have gone very differently, because the Bush administration relied on psychologists. They said that these detainees are not being harmed. And the way we know they're not being harmed is we have psychologists present, and psychologists would never allow it to happen. And that was a ludicrous claim, but it carried a lot of weight.
Finally, I'm sure you have people in your profession that like the book and like your effort here. Have you gotten any blowback on this, Dr. Idelson? Do you have maybe friends or professionals or maybe some of those who participated in this who have said, hey, you know, paraphrasing, what are you doing to us? We did what we thought was right. Any blowback on this?
Well, we have, along with fellow dissident psychologists, we have faced blowback for years and years as we tried and ultimately successfully to get the APA to change some of its policies. Mm-hmm. So the blowback started long ago. I assume the same people who were upset with us year after year are not going to be pleased with this book, but I think the book includes an important message. It documents what I consider a really tragic era for professional psychology, and I think that information needs to be available, even though undoubtedly some people are not going to be pleased.
And finally, the name of the book, Doing Harm, How the World's Largest Psychological Association Lost Its Way in the War on Terror. Pick it up, read it, come to your own conclusions. Dr. Roy J. Idelson has been the guest. Dr. Idelson, thank you. Interesting topic. Good luck, and hopefully we can chat down the road. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Dr. Roy Idelson, name of the book, Doing Harm, How the World's Largest Psychological Association Lost Its Way in the War on Terror. And if you're in the, you know, psychological field, I have family members who are in that, relatives, acquaintances, pick it up, let me know what you think.